Okay, Q&A. That's usually a bit of fun and games, a bit of entertainment, hopefully. We'll see what happens. Okay, not too many. That's great. Because sometimes when you have a lot of questions, it means people are very restless. When there's not so many questions, they might be peaceful and happy, just humming along. But when there are two teachers, sometimes it takes a bit longer because we share. So let's have a look. Dear Ajahns, during body sweep, I sometimes feel nausea, even when food has been well digested. I open my eyes to feel relief. Any advice on how I can care differently or investigate this feeling of nausea during body sweep? Right, yes. So, when we do the body sweep and when we work with the body, it's actually one of the things that is quite common. So I have maybe not mentioned that enough. When we are guiding a meditation for a body sweep, it's wonderful if you follow along. It's wonderful if you can stay with the feelings and if it's there, you know, subsiding and becoming more peaceful. But sometimes we store some of the stuff that has happened in the past in different parts of our bodies. And when we get to a certain spot in our body during a body sweep, it can be a bit overwhelming and it can be a bit strong. So what the person did here is actually the right thing to do. They opened their eyes to get a bit of relief because sometimes some parts of the body can feel a bit destabilizing. And we want to make sure that we are stable, that we feel safe, and that we feel comfortable when we are doing these practices. So, well done that you didn't just think you have to have your eyes closed and stay with that part of the body when you are overwhelmed. I often say it's like when it is raining outside, as it was today. So you don't want to be outside with not proper clothing. So if you feel a bit vulnerable and it is raining, then you kind of go inside and you go to a safe place where you're warm and protected and watch whatever is happening from a certain distance to get a bit of grounding. It's also okay to just leave out some body parts that might feel uncomfortable for a certain period of time. And just kind of skip that body part, go to another body part. Or to just be there, stay there very lightly and see what happens. But once you start to get overwhelmed, it's actually usually not so helpful to stay with it if the mind is not strong and kind enough. Yes, that's what comes to mind. I hope that is helpful. Anything to add?
The body sweeping is mainly to ground our awareness to this present moment, to this body. So we sweep, we scan the sensation. Also, we learn to let go, relax as much as possible. But in order for samadhi to go deeper, we have to let go of this body. So the scanning is basically to go through all the parts. Any parts of the body that are stiff and tight, then we try and relax it and let it disappear as soon as possible, because if not, it can be a bit of a hindrance to the deeper meditation. Because if we want to go deeper in the samadhi, we have to let go of this body. But sometimes if we have any injury or any we say stress, then this body can basically react to the condition. So if we have too much fear, then it does weaken our stomach. This from I think doctors that did study on the human body, what emotion does to the body. And if we have too much grief, then you weaken our liver. And if we have too much anger, then you weaken our heart and our brain. I'm not sure if it's anger or fear. So all these negative emotions does affect our body. So that's why it's so important that we don't hang on to any negative emotion as much as possible. So let it go as soon as possible. Because the reason why I speak from experience, I used to be very angry. I was a really angry person. Fault finding. It was to the point where my friends used to call me Mr. Grumpy. And my hand used to shake. My hearing was ringing. My eyesight was blurring. And I got almost like a headache all the time. So the emotion, they affected my health. So when I learned to watch my emotion and overcome it with loving kindness and forgiveness, and especially matter to oneself, so that enabled me to let go of my fear, anxiety, and anger. Then I noticed it actually helped allow my body to be at ease and to heal itself more rapidly. I used to get so angry and upset that I don't sleep for 2 weeks. So it was really affecting me, affecting my body and my mental well-being. So you might notice that I'm calm and relaxed. But if you meet me before I was Buddhist, I used to be a really angry person.
Long hair, beard.
I think not putting people down up in the minds, but up in the mining side, is a tough community. When you have a lot of men working together, it can be very competitive. So the Buddha say, if you don't associate with wise people, it can really pull you down. It's long hair, beer. I used to be drinking and smoking a lot. I'm not going into too many details. So this negative emotion does affect our body. And it do arise. We have to be gentle and just let go. Let go of the body as soon as possible. The more we can let go, then we can stay with the breath. Because this emotional is a part of the mindfulness of our emotion and our body. So we know that if it comes, if we don't react, then hopefully it will disappear. I mean, main reason why I did meditation was just to heal my body. Because I knew that I was basically falling apart, becoming a bit of a basket case. But since I've been practicing meditation, I hardly get sick. Maybe I might get sick once a year from COVID. But I tend to heal really rapidly. Okay, thank you.
One thing that I also like doing to ground myself a little bit, I have guided meditations like this before, but not on this retreat, to actually, instead of looking for the tensions that you have in your body, to just scan for the areas that feel really comfortable, that feel really relaxed, that feel really tingly. So I don't know how it is for you, but I've already alluded a little bit to it in one of the meditations, that the hands for me are an area that is quite comfortable most of the time. And also the feet. They're actually very, very sensitive. And for some people also, the heart area can be a difficult area, but for other people it can be an area which is also very kind of warm and open and tingly. And then rather to approach those areas that are problematic for you head on, so to speak, is to kind of come from the side, come from the back door, come through the back door. So you are focusing on those areas that feel really nice, that feel really comfortable, and then you spread that energy throughout your body. And you let it touch all different parts of your body, and you let it extend, flow over into those areas that might be problematic and that might be painful or making you nauseous. So that's another thing you can try. Okay, that was that?
Yeah.
All right. Any tip to improve the ability to letting go thoughts and ego. Any recommended deep guided meditation? Okay. Over to you.
Okay.
We usually go back and forth. Letting go of thoughts and ego. Any recommended deep guided meditations?
The thoughts is hard because we do think a lot. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. Sometimes I find that it's easier just to stay with a monkey mind. And once I have enough of overthinking, sometimes if I do think a lot, I will sit with it for like maybe an hour or 2 hours. And I say, have you had enough yet? Okay. If you have enough, that okay, then you can be quiet now. So sometimes I give myself loving kindness to oneself. So my mind and my thoughts, it's almost like a child that's always crying and complaining for attention. So I have to be really gentle and patient with my mind. So once my mind stops complaining and crying, then I give myself loving kindness and say, okay, you have enough of thinking all the crazy thoughts and be negative. So now you can basically just be quiet. And it's like a child that's always asking for attention. So once the child finishes chucking a tantrum, then you just got to give a lot of loving kindness and gentleness to that child. Then the child will just calm down and go to sleep. Yep. So I do admit our thoughts is very hard. And the ego is even harder to let go. It needs a mind that's very still and calm. And sometimes you need to go in very deep samadhi to understand and see that. But very few people, even monastic, can go into deep samadhi. But in the deep state of samadhi, the mind is so calm and so peaceful. Like when you come out from deep samadhi, you can't even think. Like thinking is almost like you have to use a lot of effort just to think and to want and to crave. It's a mind so calm and so peaceful and so still. There's almost no movement of mind. So because all movement of mind comes from the self and the ego. Yep. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, so basically you also want to make sure that you don't feed those thoughts. And as Bhantichandra was saying, that when you just let them run out, they will run out eventually. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it's a bit quicker. And that's actually not, you know, thoughts at this stage, but it is a specific type of thought. I was just remembering what Ajahn Chah used to say when people came to ask him about anger and said, oh, I'm so angry. And how can I deal with my anger? And he told them, take out a clock, put it in front of you, and see how long you can be angry for, if you can beat your record. So basically, you are kind of making a bit of fun out of this thing. And with anger, you realize that anger needs to be fed. Anger needs thoughts. Anger needs an object to focus on. Oh, that person, or oh, that event, or oh, you're looking for someone to blame. You're looking for some kind of solution. And every time you think about it, it feeds the anger. It feeds the fire of anger. But if you start throwing on the fuel onto that fire, the fire will actually slowly die down and dissipate. Of course, you can also extinguish a fire, but that is a bit more difficult. But if you have mindfulness and if you have wisdom, then that can take the oxygen off the fire, or it can actually act like water to extinguish that fire. And then it can happen a little bit more quickly. And then the ego basically plays into thinking as well. So if we would be imagining just sitting there and hearing the thoughts of the person sitting next to us, then we won't give them a lot of importance. We will just think, oh, you know, it's just another person saying something or thinking something. And then we can kind of dismiss it. We can let it die down fairly quickly. But when we think it's our thoughts, they belong to us, they're important to us, then they are much, much more difficult to let go of. Any recommended deep guided meditation? I'm not quite sure. But I think every guided meditation actually guides you slowly towards allowing the thinking to get slower and slower and slower, and then eventually even disappear. And the same thing with the ego. But you can't make it happen. That's one of the problems. Once you start to get involved, you're actually feeding the process. Hope that helps. Any more?
Yeah. With the recommendation on meditation, mm-hmm. I think even monks and nuns and practitioners, it's quite personal. You have to basically practice, engage your own practice. The more you practice, the more you understand. I mean, when I was in Melbourne, one of the supporters asked me, my teaching is pretty good. I'm pretty good at teaching. So she asked me, how do you learn to teach so well? And I told her, because I suffer so much. That's why I can teach this pretty good. Yeah. So I also recall, someone did ask Ajahn Chah, why his wisdom is so good. Maybe did he re-study the suttas a lot? Or did he read the Abhidharma? And Ajahn Chah says when he was young, he was full of defilements. Yep. So he's got very strong hindrance. The five hindrances are very strong in his mind. So Ajahn Chah also says he suffered a lot too. So that's why he's wise. For monks, it's funny. Sometimes in order for us to develop wisdom, the more we suffer, the more we understand suffering, and the more we learn to overcome it through just learning to be patient, learning to let go, and learning to accept the suffering in the mind. Because being by yourself in the forest with the kangaroo, some days are very nice, but I remember in the early days, I think some of the monks, we do suffer a lot. We suffer from being alone, away from family. There wasn't any internet in the early days here. Yep. So internet, we did have an office now, so the monks can check the emails these days. But in the early days, there wasn't no internet, and especially no live streaming Dharma talk. So things for here was very simple. So all we have is our mind and our body. And this mind and body can be very irritable. But boy, I remember the early days. I suffered so much. It was a lot of, a lot of wisdom arise from understanding this suffering that arises in this body to the point where it become numb. Once you become numb from the pain and suffering, then when you let go, you feel that freedom and peace. So I don't know. I hope that's... I don't know. You think that was pretty bad? Should I say things like that?
Sure.
But I'm trying to be
it's
honest.
Yes.
I'm trying to be honest. Yes. So don't think the monks here are having a great time. Yeah. But sometimes we have to go through a lot of pain. I think for people that have stayed in the monastery long enough, they can understand what we mean. So wisdom do arise, but it's very slowly. Through a lot of practice, endurance, and patience. Yep. So Some of the monks or lay people, we don't have strong parameters. So it's not going to happen overnight. Yep. So it takes time. So just patient. And don't give up. So as long as we're patient, we don't give up, then we will slowly overcome our suffering. Okay, thank you.
Great, next one. Any survival tips on how to deal with a dying parent? How to cope with grief? Right, okay, that's right up my alleyway. I was recently in Switzerland for 4 months because my mom was passing away. So I had the privilege to be with her for her last roughly 2.5 months. And then also to be with my family and her friends and to do the memorial service and to go through this whole process of what that entails. So, yeah, it's basically a talk by itself, and it's already recorded. I gave this talk in Newbury, or actually in the Buddhist Society of Victoria recently. So you can go and check it out on YouTube if you're interested. But just to give you some kind of maybe advice or some bit of what I talked about is, through Buddhism we get conditioned to accept and to understand that dying and that sickness are part of life, and that they are not something we have to be afraid of, that they're not something which is out of the ordinary, and that it is something which can be a good opportunity of learning as well. When sickness comes, when death comes, it kind of focuses our mind as well, because we realize that when life is going good, that we sometimes waste quite a lot of time, that we are not aware of the preciousness of life. And it can really kind of focus our mind. When someone dies, there can be grief, but it's also wonderful to see that the people that are left behind when a person passes away can actually come together and support each other. And that's what I strongly felt at that memorial service as well, that was really for the people who were left behind, and that was a good time to come together, to show solidarity, to remember all the good things that had happened to us because of that person who has passed away, and that we can also share merits with that person, that we can carry the goodness and that they have brought into this world in our own hearts, and that we also know that the goodness that we have shared with them is not lost. It's something they carry in their hearts, because in Buddhism we believe that we don't just die and vanish and that's it. We actually get reborn. We go on another journey, and the things that are imprinted in our minds, they stay with us through those lifetimes. So what we have given and what we have received, if we value it, if we treasure it, if we nourish it, it's something which informs our lives. And in that sense, the person who has gone, who has left us, is still with us in our own heart. And the person who has parted will still have their friends, their family, their close ones in their own hearts as well. But we have gone separate ways. We can't really communicate with each other so well anymore as we did in the past. But what often happens is that people do even have some contact with people who have passed away, when they maybe also come and say farewell, or they have sometimes quite vivid dreams where they remember the people who have passed away. So the connection is not completely cut, but it's just kind of much, much further away. It's like when you have someone who is overseas, who you can't reach so easily anymore. Maybe kind of like in the time when the internet didn't exist and when we couldn't Zoom and Skype and WhatsApp or whatever each other, where we actually had to write letters and where it took a long time, or we had to make a phone call, which was very complicated and very difficult. So grief is very normal and it's very natural, but when you have been conditioned by Buddhism, then you will have less grief. Then you will have less sadness, because you understand that this is the normal way of how things go in this world.
Anyway, that's what comes to mind. But as I said, there is more information on YouTube if you want to go and check that out. Or you can also talk to me later on if there is anything specific that you are interested in. Any experience for you?
Okay, so I mean, the only thing that come to my mind is, as Buddhist monk, we do go and see a lot of supporters. They are basically getting old and dying. And one thing that really inspired me is sometimes when we go to see some of our supporters that are in their 80s, that have been practicing Dharma for all through their life, listening to Ajahn Brahm's Dharma talk, studying the suttas, and coming to do retreats. I mean, one of the most inspiring things is this old striking lady. She's in her 80s, and she's in a care home, and she only got maybe a few months to live. So, well, she don't have long to live, so she'll call up her family member. So his niece was married to one of the monks in the monastery. So the monk is one of my friend. So myself and my friend will go and visit the niece auntie. So as part of the family member of the Buddhist monk. So one thing was quite inspiring when we went and visit this old ranking lady. When we went to her room, she was always at ease, happy, and joyful. So even she was dying, she realized getting old, having the body fall apart. Her body was falling apart, and she knew she didn't have long to live. But her mind was radiating and at peace. So there was a lot of happiness and joy in her face. So myself and my friend will give a blessing to this supporter. And when we leave, she's always happy to see us leave. And when we leave the nursing home, I notice the other nursing home people, you can feel the fear, the anxiety, the worry, and also the loss in their eyes. Because I notice the older people, they are not Buddhists, or don't do any spiritual practice, or don't develop the mind. As they get older, there's a lot of fear in their eye, a lot of worry, and a lot of loss and confusion. So in this nursing home, there's people in the 80s, 70s, and even 90s. And their mind's all over the place. But this old striking lady, she's at peace and happy. So for myself and this my friend, we went to see her, I think, about 3 or 4 times before she passed away. But when we go and visit her, she's happy to see us. We give her a blessing. Then we leave, and she goes back to normal. Then she says she's sick again, and the family call us. We went there. We see her. We give her a blessing. Then we left her. Then she went back to normal. So it happened a few times. I think it's for a year before she passed away. Yeah. So the Sangha is very powerful for our supporters. So when we come and see them, they get a lot of energy and boost from seeing the Sangha. Yeah. Anyway, it's quite very inspiring to see someone that's been practicing for all their life. And at peace and at ease. It's like her mind is very, very clear and at ease. And we say there wasn't any fear. Like she was very happy to see the monks. There's no sense of fear from her. She was very glad to see the monks before she passed away. So that's one thing I noticed, seeing our old supporters. It's just there's a big difference from someone that practices and someone that don't practice. So someone that don't practice, their mind's lost. It's like there's so much confusion because they know their body is falling apart and they're losing their mind. But for someone that have practiced, Even the body is falling apart. They know it's an aging process, but their mind is very mature and clear. Okay, thank you.
That also reminds me of one of the benefits of metta. It says in one of the suttas that one of the benefits of practicing metta, of making it a refuge, so to speak, in your life, is that you will die peacefully. And also, actually, what you were telling was very similar with my mom. I mean, she's not a Buddhist, but she has a Buddhist son. She's seen me for a while. So she was terminal in December last year, and that's why I traveled to Switzerland. And she was, in her bed and basically not leaving her bed and, eating less and less. And they thought, it's not going to take much longer. And I got there, and she got some energy again. And she, started eating again, and we could put her in a wheelchair and go and have lunch together or dinner together. So we had a bit more time together. So it gave her a boost of energy. And she actually had that fear and that confusion that Bhante was talking about, which was quite difficult to watch in the beginning. But she did lose it over time. I would say about within the last week of her life, somehow, she managed to become peaceful and to let go of her fear, or the fear rather let go of her, and she could pass away peacefully. So that was very precious. Okay. Oho. What is aura? Okay, here we go. That's more of a New Age question, isn't it? That's actually your question.
My question.
We go back and forth. Okay. Yes. What is aura?
Okay, so I'm just guessing aura is. So aura is a force field or energy in a person's mind. So that's what I guess aura is. And sometimes you look at some of the Christian saints where you have a picture, and there's a halo around them. So, yeah, maybe aura and halo are the same. So when you look at the Buddha's image, you see there's a flame on top. So this is a flame of enlightenment and wisdom. And also a mind that's pure and bright and completely free and awakened. Yep. So that's why I reckon aura is... And for practitioner, even lay practitioner, sometimes I meet some of them, they have very good samadhi, where they go very deep, and they might become very pure, bright and radiant. And sometimes they tell me, Bhante, how do you sleep at night? And I say, what do you mean by that? And they say that sometimes after deep samadhi, they'll be lying in their bed with the eye open in a dark room. But the mind is so bright and radiant and clear. It's almost like sleeping with a light open or turned on in their room. So that's the light of wisdom within the mind. So you see, when people go into deep samadhi, the mind becomes so radiant, calm, peaceful, and bright. So even you come out of deep samadhi, the mind is still going with so much energy and brightness. And sometimes I ask them, so when you go outside and look at the star, can you see the stars? Sometimes they say no, they can't see the stars, but the mind is radiant and bright. Yep. So yeah, so sometimes that inner light comes from the mind that's pure and bright. So I guess that can be called an aura tool. So if people have psychic abilities, or when their mind is so peaceful and clear, and you see a person that have a pure mind, there's a very strong aura in them. So I hope that makes sense.
Yes, I mean, what I'm kind of familiar with, or what I've heard, which is not Buddhism per se, but there is some people who have the ability to see an aura, see what kind of like light emitting from some people. But I always feel it's important to
let people know that it is also a perception, and that each perception is always colored by the person who is seeing that. Everything we see is always colored by the way we perceive the world as well. So it's not, what shall we say, it's not the truth, it's not, it's like an image, and it has a certain value, but yeah, we have to be careful not to give it too much emphasis. Anyway, that's what comes to mind for me about aura. Okay. When do you contemplate and how? Many thanks. Okay. So, contemplation usually in Buddhist terms is happening once the mind is peaceful and calm, and once the mind is able to have an object and be settled on that object, and to just see much more deeper into whatever the mind is looking at. So contemplation is not thinking. It is a wisdom, it is an understanding that arises from a peaceful, still, calm, clear mind, which settles, or which is directed to a certain object, and then just remains on that object for long enough to get some information which otherwise wouldn't be able to be gathered. I hope that makes sense. To maybe say something which is a bit closer to some people's experience, what I mentioned this afternoon, I think it was. When your mind is peaceful and calm and you go and walk outside, you can stop and rest your eyes on an object for much, much longer without getting bored. And when you do that, you can see much, much more detail. And you can see sometimes the hidden beauty that I talked about, but you can sometimes also see some kind of things that you can't figure out by thinking. It suddenly just kind of strikes you, some kind of idea, some kind of insight comes up. So that's what contemplation is, as far as I know, in Buddhism, and how to do it. Anything to add?
Yeah, I think that's pretty straightforward. So a mind that's free from defilements, like there's no strong greed, hate, also delusion coming from a self of ego. So a mind that's basically quite pure or free from the defilements, then if you make a decision with a mind that's not defiled or biased, then you see it's good to reflect, and wisdom arises when the mind is free from all those hindrances. Okay, thank you.
Okay, your turn. Oh, we're doing well. Ajahn's, thank you for your happy guidance. I'm glad to be on this journey. Will you please briefly outline the Eightfold Path? All right, very good. So we talked about the Four Noble Truths a little bit before. So there is imperfection in the world. There is suffering in the world, and suffering arises because we have greed, because we want things to be in a certain way and don't realize that by just wanting, it doesn't happen. And the Third Noble Truth is the realization how we can let go of that wanting, how we can lessen that wanting, how we can be more content and let go of craving. And then the last part is the Eightfold Path. And it has three sections, three parts. Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. So it usually starts with Panya, with wisdom, with having enough understanding and clarity why we are practicing, what the whole path is about. And then we practice virtue, which is Sila. So we develop the goodness within our own hearts. And then we become still. we practice meditation. We practice the collectedness of the mind. And that's the Eightfold Path, briefly, in a nutshell. I hope it's not too brief. You want to add some things here and there, or?
I think it's pretty good, because my Pali is not really good. I like to practice. I'm not an intellectual monastic.
Okay, leave it at that.
Very good.
Next one. Did I skip you? Or this is your one, isn't it? Ho, ho, ho. Okay. Knowing that milk production involves the removal and slaughter of calves, why do Buddhists still drink milk? It does not seem to match the philosophy of loving kindness of all creatures. Much love. From the cows. No, from everyone. What do you reckon?
I'll just go back to what the Buddha said. Yeah? So for monastic, the only time we don't eat meat, if we see an animal that is killed, we see it and we heard it, and we know that it's actually killed, especially for the monks or nuns, then we should not take that consumption of flesh or animal. So if I go and visit my parents, and my parents order live fish, then I don't accept the animal that's killed, because there is some direct karmic connection involving killing. So that's what the Buddha say, not to accept anything that's actually, if we hear it, we see it, and also it was killed, is better for us, then we should avoid it. But if it's bought from a shop or a shopping centre, then there's no connection on harming that being. But so we're not harming that being. We're not responsible for ordering the slaughter of that animal. I think the reason why is during the Buddhist time, some people are very poor. So if they have anything they can offer the Sangha, they'll offer it to make merit. So for monastic, we cannot be too choosy and say that we have to be vegetarian or we give our meat completely. Usually we accept whatever our lay supporter will support us, will offer us. Because if we start becoming very choosy, then it becomes a burden to our supporter. Because we heard a lot of argument that monks and nuns should not accept meat, but if we start to become very picky and choosy, then we can be very demanding and very difficult and hard to support. So sometimes our compassion for our supporter, you see, we just accept what is given from our supporter, because if we are too picky and choosy, it becomes a bit of a hassle and a bit of a pain to take care of the monastic, because I heard of other monastic, they only want organic food, the best chemical free, premium food and stuff that's wholesome. It becomes very expensive for our lay people to support monastic that is very high standard. So we try and keep to a lower standard. Yep. So that's come to my mind. Do you have something?
Yeah, and you basically want to value and encourage the generosity of the lay people. And if they have a strong conviction that they don't want to use, milk that has caused a lot of suffering, or eat meat, or, have a share in processes that harm a lot of other beings, then we, of course, support that. Well done. Please carry on doing that. And we will gladly accept what you bring to the monastery and what you offer us with a pure heart. But we don't want to exclude people who don't have an emphasis on these things. Sometimes you kind of have to choose your battles in life. And well done and good on you for the people who choose that area to protect and to and not harm living beings like animals in this world. But unfortunately, in this world, there will be some harm done, even if you are, eating a purely vegetarian diet. There will be some animals killed in the process. And I think the best we can do is have the best of intentions, try what we can do, and lessen the harm. But by being alive, by breathing, by eating, by driving, by whatever it is, we do unfortunately harm other beings. But it's very important that we make sure that we don't do it intentionally, that we don't do it with anger. Sometimes some of the activists, maybe put it this way, have very pure and very good ideas, but they get caught up in an unwholesome energy. Not just the activists, whoever actually, basically. So if you are fighting for something, it's great if you do it for yourself, you feel good about it, if people ask about it, you encourage them to help. But when you develop anger or irritation about people who might have a different opinion or might have a different lifestyle, you're actually bringing something else into the world which is not so wholesome. But we all basically try our best. It is a very tricky question, and I hope we have more or less answered it.
Yes, I think this question is very sensitive because no matter how we answer it, it's almost impossible to please everyone because what to do? We do live in a society where it's convenient. And for monastic, we try and make it simple. But if we basically stop all meat consumption, then the monastery might be very hard to support the monastic. And there might not be so many monks joining the community because some monastic, if they don't get enough protein, they tend not to be that healthy. They become quite sickly. So it's a tough one. So like myself, sometimes I'm a vegetarian, but I do admit that if I go to a place and I just don't accept what they're given, some are supposed to get really angry. Because I remember one time, they come over all the way from home, 2 hours driving, just to offer dana to the monastic. And I was the only monk there. So I only took all the healthy food and left all some of the stuff that's not healthy. And I turned around and I look at that person, and he was really like fuming at me. So I was going, how come? And I realized, geez, he probably drove all the way to the monastery. And I just took all the healthy stuff and left all the unhealthy stuff. So how compassion for that person. I just put almost everything inside and just ate what was healthy. And what was unhealthy, I just put it somewhere else later. So it's a tough one. And I realized as a monastic, we can't please everyone. Yep. So, but I think there are some Buddhist groups that are mainly vegetarian. And they're fine. They have no problem. But sometimes, if they go in that direction and they don't follow the Buddhist precept, then it can basically... What I mean by example is you have some other Buddhist group, they start farming and start eating plants only. Then they basically establish a monastery up in the mountains, in the hill in Asia. Then basically... they get disconnected from the Sangha, then Buddhism in that country basically disappeared. Yep, because things were changed so much just to suit their lifestyle and not to do any harm to any beings. So Lord Buddha put all these rules for a reason, to make it easier for the Sangha to conduct their business and their teaching, and easier for our lay supporter to support us. If we're too picky and we want the best organic food, the fine premium food, then it might end up one day people don't want to support us because we're just too much of a headache. Yeah, so why don't they make it easier for our supporters? So like for a lot of the monks in Bodhiyana, quite a few are vegetarian and they don't eat meat. So it's up to the monastic to decide. So as for Sangha, we don't go and reinforce people. Yep, and tell them you have to stop eating meat. If not, you cannot join the community. So there's compassion towards our practitioner and also our supporter. Yep. So it's very hard one, and there's heaps and massive argument over it. So for us, we just want to stay neutral. And don't get too involved into picking sides, because we have lay people that if we don't support them, they just leave. They go down to the monastery where there's many vegetarian monks and nuns. That's fine. Yep, that's fine. It's okay. Because sometimes people have their own views and we must respect that. Thank you. Because sometimes I met some people that they eat so pure in their stomach, but in the mind they're so angry. So in Buddhism, it's good to purify the mind, not to purify your stomach. Okay, sorry, maybe that's a bad joke.
Yeah, I was actually quite a strict vegetarian myself as a layperson, and I also lived in a center. For the people who know Aya Kema, I lived in her monastery in Germany for 2 years. She wasn't around at that time anymore, sadly, but they were strictly vegetarian, so I had a vegetarian diet at that time and was perfectly fine. But I'm a bit of a flexitarian at the moment. That's what they call it, isn't it? Okay, dear Venerable Ajahns, couldn't hear this morning meditation guidance. Maybe a problem with the mic, with Metta. Okay, this morning?
Must be me.
That was you?
Yes, sorry. I tend to speak very softly. And the reason why I speak that is I tend to just guide people into a calm state. And I tend to use my voice to guide myself into calmness and peace. And also I use that to guide other people too. Because I find that I've been to some monastery where the monastic, the way they teach is like scolding people. And that also, some people like it. But I find it's almost...
It's not your style.
Yeah, it's not my style. And it does not lead to a calm, peaceful meditation. So, yeah, I only do what works. I mean, I used to be angry myself, so I know the harm and danger of being too strict and forceful. Yep, so I'll speak louder and more gently. Okay.
I mean, another option is these things are recorded on YouTube. And I think the sound level there from the microphones that is picked up here is pretty okay. And there you can also put the headphones in and listen to it later if you want. But I also feel that what is really more important than hearing the exact words is getting the vibes of what is happening in this room. And you will be able to feel that even if you don't hear it properly. Anyway, that's our excuse when technology doesn't work. Okay. Last one. We are quick. That's great. Here. Can you please explain about the link between seven chakras and meditation? Oh, another one. You want to have a crack at it?
I don't know. I never really heard of this, the seven chakras in Theravada Buddhism.
No, it's not really.
Yeah, I think it might be another different group. I know Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about this a lot.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they talk about different chakras. Yep. But in Theravada, we don't really talk about things like that because because Lord Buddha never talk about things like that. Yep, so sorry, I can't really answer your questions. But the only thing I can talk about is the different energy. So for the body is made out of four elements. So that's something that the Buddha did talk about. You got the fire element, it's the heat in our stomach. Then you got the water element, it's all the fluid in our body. Then you got the air element, it's what we breathe in through our lungs. Then you have the earth element, it's basically, I think, the bones and the structure of this body. Yeah? Yep. So these are the four elements. Wind, air, water, and earth. Is that correct?
Well, wind and air would be the same.
Sorry, wind and air. Okay. Yeah. So if these elements are not balanced, then it can lead to like too much heat. Or, so it's basically in Buddhism, we believe in just the right balance. So we don't go meditating in the cold and basically dampen the heat element. So heat element is in our stomach. But in some Buddhist group, like the dependent Buddhism, they use the heat element to heat up this whole body. So what they do when they meditate, they focus their mind on the heat of the stomach, and they are allowed to expand and radiate all through the body. So when you do that, everything starts to heat up, and it starts to become very hot. So yep, so that's what I heard. And I did try it myself once, and yeah, my body started becoming pretty hot. I was going, okay, I will stop. Because I was staying in a monastery, and it was getting really cold. So I said, I'll try that out. And I did listen to a talk about someone describe how to generate the heat element. So I used my mind to focus on the heat and allow it to spread through my body. And after a while, I said, okay, it's going to be too hot. I said, I need to stop. Yeah, so that's one way of talking about the elements. So maybe it's close to what the chakras are. Okay.
Thanks a lot for your questions. I hope there were some useful and maybe also a bit of entertaining things there. It's always nice for us to get a bit of feedback through the questions as well. And I don't know about yourself, but for myself, I also quite enjoy the interviews, because there you can actually talk to a person. And when they ask a question, you can ask a follow-up question. You can get a bit more information, because sometimes when you're answering a question and you don't really know what the intention of the question is or from what person it comes, it might kind of shoot off the target. So sorry if that has happened with some of those questions, but we try our best. What I would like to do as well for tonight, for the meditation, if you want to sit quietly for a bit longer afterwards, because it's not that late, we did the Q&A session a bit earlier than a lot of the other teachers do, is to reflect again on the universal well-being, on the chant of the universal well-being, and to kind of give that energy to you, to carry you through the rest of the day, and as I was describing this afternoon, hopefully also to carry you into the night, into a peaceful sleep, and into a nice, bright, happy, beautiful day tomorrow, our last day that we have together. I don't know if you, whoops, bang, bing, if you still have the sheets, some of you, if you would like to join in. And that's the one you got with the, what was that other one called? With the notes from the manager. And I'll let Junda start, because then I don't chant too high. Sometimes my voice, I have a teener voice, and it gets a bit too high, and then people can't follow so well. If Junda starts, then my voice is a bit deeper. Okay, here we go.
So let us...
May I abide, we start there.
Okay. So we talk.
This one.
Oh,
may
okay.
I abide, yes.
Okay. May I abide in well-being, in freedom from affliction, in freedom from hostility, in freedom from ill will, in freedom from anxiety,
And may I maintain well-being in myself. May everyone abide in well-being, in freedom from hostility, in freedom from ill will, in freedom from anxiety, and may they maintain well-being in themselves. May all beings be released from all suffering, and may they not be deterred from the good fortune they may have gained. When I act upon intention, all beings are their owners of their action, and inherit their results. The future is born from such action, companioned into this action, and its result will be their home. All actions with intention, will be skillful or unful, or such action, they will be in air.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu. So, have a peaceful evening, have a peaceful night.
Yep, and
see you tomorrow.
Yep, and please forgive us if we say anything wrong by body, speech, or mind. Because as monastic, we're not perfect. We are just human beings, and we try our best. So sometimes things that we say might be hurtful to some people. So may I ask forgiveness for that. So we are just trying our best. And sometimes with good intention, that's all we can do. So yeah, so please forgive us by body, speech, and mind if we say something wrong. Okay, thank you.